Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and blessings, blessings and greetings, blessed souls. We're alive because we want to stay alive in Soul Class 341 in search of ancient, authentic Torah. We're broadcasting live right now from Turtle Island, the USA, unifying souls. Actually, we plan to vibe out on the following verse from Genesis. Chapter 14, verse 15, quote, "And the Creator said to him," meaning Cain, "Therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be wrought upon him sevenfold. And the Creator placed the mark on Cain, that no one who find him slay him." A question can rise within the human mind. What was the mark that was placed upon Cain? Was it the mark of the beast? Or was that mark something we of the 21st century can learn from and integrate within our blessed living experience, person by person, until the entire human family experience can benefit from to improve life here on earth? As well, we plan to vibe out on teachings from Rambam, Chabad / Breslov Chassidus, plus, and be flexible to handle any surprise call-in from blessed souls from anywhere, from the human fair experience, may Abba Khan for arts from the four corners of the earth on this blessed planet. Meanwhile, may the infinite creator bless you and your loved ones peacefully and pleasantly. The calling number, if you want to participate for a live dialogue, is 347-838-8669. And by the way, if you go to the link for the promo of this show, there's a very special video with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Sosa Yogan Aleinu, may his merits protect us, talks about how infinite beings can tie into the grid of the infinite creator who spoke and the world came to be. With that being said, we're going to turn down the music from blessed brother and prayer partner and spiritual brother and member of the famous Frankel Shul here, Kesser Crown Heights, and also the president of Beit Mazal, a place where if you want to learn how to pray in a Sephardic way, it will make your day to make it over to Beit Mazal. You can go to connect to Isaac Bitton's Facebook page at ISAACBITTON. Just tell him Don Zusia, Torah Askan, Torah activist, recommended you connect with him. By the way, blessed souls, I just want to mention as a caveat, as a Torah Askan, Torah activist, although I say with the merit and blessings of being so, a follower of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Schus Yogan Aleinu, a member of the Lubavitcher community here in Crown Heights, I am not representing any organization or official position of the Lubavitcher movement. I am merely speaking as an individual member of the nation of the Israelite Hebrew Jewish congregations all around the world. Therefore, my word is not the final authoritative one. I'm not the chief rabbi of anyone, but consider me to be your cyberspace librarian, sharing with you teachings of Torah, which you might not have accessed from the Hebrew to English or from the oral Torah tradition, how much more so. With that being said, we're going to turn down the music to Rabbi Isaac Vitone. Please forgive me, Rabbi Isaac, and here we go on with the shoe. Okay, there we go with that. Now, blessed souls, I had gotten the impression that Torah, or I should say Rambam activist, teacher and student Dennis Ryan would appear on today's show. He has been vacationing, Baruch Hashem, pleasure to be the creator, blissfully up in Vermont, and I also try to reach the Ben Noah activist, Ron Williams. So it could be, quite possibly be, that we're going solo today. Also, I just want to mention to you that I got into a very, very deep discussion via private messaging, and it was also semi-public, with a friend who lives down in Alabama, for sure, I guess for some people called Sweet Home Alabama. And he had something to discuss with me, and we didn't really come to a final resolution, but the question that I thought I would pose, if anyone wants to call in, is do you feel, for those of you who have gone through experience of trying to be convert, to become a Torah adhering Jew, were somehow felt like the doors were closed on you? Now, I was born to a Jewish mother and a Jewish father, but in particular because my mother is Jewish, according to the laws of Israel, I am an Israelite proper. And anyone who wants to become an Israelite can do so, but there's a certain procedure according to the written and oral Torah traditions. I'm not going to go into that. Neither do I try to recruit children of Noah, of the blessed nations of the world, from Kol Mishpachat Adamah, from all the families of the earth, to become an Israelite Hebrew Jew. That's not my job. Rather, I try to vibe out on the seven Noahic commandments. And when we do that, we try to do with utmost sincerity and care for those who are seeking to integrate within their current spiritual lifestyles, within their faith-based communities, those seven universal laws that were originally transmitted to Adam and Noah. Well, there is an opinion that only six commandments were given to Adam, because there was no commandment for him concerning, according to that opinion, to the prohibition of eating the limb of an animal while it was still alive, because he was not allowed to eat meat. That permissibility came after the flood, where you see clearly that the Most High instructed Noah and his descendants, which is all of us, and again re-instructed us as the nation of Israel, along with the children of Noah, at the Mount Sinai experience, that meat could be eaten. So that being said, blessed souls, we again are involved in trying to offer up perspectives that, in a way that I don't consider as Pollyannish, but rather in a way that will encourage human beings to get to know each other much better. And part of that process is, I know many people have questions about the nature of our people's traditions, and we share them, and we share the insights that are given about our people, the good points and the points that need improvement, as well as the Torah testifies to the written and oral Torah traditions concerning the nations of the world. But before we go on further, we want to start the show as we have done on many programs recently. First of all, our utmost prayers and humble blessings upon the state of California, which I still think is in dire need, for the good portion of it, for bountiful amounts of water to come in a way that will nurture the vegetation out there, nurture the trees, nurture the grass, of course, provide sufficient drinking water for the blessed inhabitants of California. Also, in the merit of today's show, we wish to send out a refuah shlema, complete healing, for the following individuals: Meir Nisim ben Rachel, Chaim ben Tova, Yosef ben Luna Luisa, Yehuda David ben Brocha, Ori Maital Bas Bela, Rus Bas Ahuva. And for anyone who I didn't mention, because I know unfortunately there are too many people in the world that are sick, may in the merit of what's going to be discussed today serve as a potent conduit of accessing from that level where Most High is called the Rofei Kol Basar, the healer of all flesh, in a way that should be recognizable in those people who need Refuah Shlema, that they should go from strength to strength and testify that even if their treatment process was by natural medical means or holistic means or alternative means, it all can be traced back to Rofei Kol Basar, the healer of all flesh. So now we're going to pluck out from a book called The Letter in Spirit, which was selected and arranged by Rabbi Dr. Nissim Mendel of blessed memory. And the matter was continued on to its fruition via his son-in-law, Rav Shapiro of Crown Heights, here in Brooklyn, New York. And this section we're reading from is called The Perplexed, where questions were asked of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, how does one deal with certain situations where one is left, so to speak, virtually or allegorically scratching one's head about certain conditions within the human individual life experience. So let's go right into it. This is a letter dating back to 5727, which would correspond either to 1966 or 1967. The date of the letter was not written in terms of the Hebrew date, so it just says that just as the Hebrew calendar year, so I assume it's approximately from 48 to 47 years ago. And here is the letter. And I'm plucking from it. It was written to someone, a man, who lived in E period S period Kilda, Victoria, Australia. The other side of the world. And the Rebbe mentioned that he received the letter. And this person wrote to the Rebbe, talking about things that he does not understand, in particularly the suffering of his father. And so the question was posed, or should God, Creator, make any good person suffer? The Rebbe's response, judging by your letter, it is surely unnecessary to explain to you at length that it is certainly not surprising that a human being does not understand the ways of God. For a created being cannot surely understand the Creator. It is only due to God's infinite kindness that He has revealed to man certain aspects of His divine providence. Think of a young child who is told to sit down and learn the alphabet or do his homework and the like. The child, while complying with these instructions, is not doing so because he realizes the superior wisdom of his elders, but because he has no choice in the matter, since he is compelled by his father or mother or teacher to do so. Insomuch as the child is concerned, it is true suffering to be deprived of fresh air or play or rest or other activities which are generally considered good for children. Nevertheless, of what consideration is the child's temporary suffering, even if it extends for days or months, in comparison with the good that he will enjoy for the rest of his life by virtue of his compliance and learning how to learn the basics, the fundamentals of language, whether it be recognizing the symbols of language, writing down the symbols of language, combining different types of letters within that language so they can express themselves. And we should never underestimate, as I mentioned in a parenthetical manner, blessed souls, that at any one time when you don't feel to someone, or you don't physically have access to someone for whatever reason, I don't know, you're out in the woods and you just have this desire to start speaking to someone, of course you can speak to the Almighty Creator because He has the ear that, allegorically speaking, that hears anything that we say. He has the mind that can read any thought that we think, and He has the divine means of recording all of our activities in the divine tablets above in heaven, the divine ledger, so to speak. So I just want to emphasize that a means of expressing one's feelings, good, positive, or somewhere in between those two, or feelings of suffering, write it down as well, as I do know as a participant and an active worker in the mental health field. It is very therapeutic for the individuals that I work with who are classified as having severe mental illness when they record their thoughts down on paper, when they just can't seem to bring out their thoughts out by virtue of speech to write them down. So, again, going back to this letter by the Rebbe, in the Torah it is frequently explained and emphasized that life on this earth is only a preparation for the future everlasting life of the world to come. And I think many faith-based perspectives hold by this. We have a Mishnah, which is in the Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, meaning the sages of Israel, going to chapter 4, verse 16, where the Mishnah states, this world is like a corridor to the future world. Prepare yourself in this corridor so you may enter the banqueting hall of the future world. Now, are we talking about, you know, so we can have a smorgasbord, you know, eat our favorite foods, or are we talking about the spiritual sustenance which we imbibe in this world and the acts of kindness and the prayers and the blessings we offer up upon other people, as well for our own families? This is by which we will be feasting on the energy, the positive energy that was subdued towards a higher cause to make this world a better place, a conduit for the indwelling of Shekhinah, the Divine Presence. With that being said, the Rebbe continued, now if it happens that during one's time in this corridor, there has been a period of suffering, but that this suffering is not compensated by the infinite gain in the banqueting hall, which was allegorically mentioned before. And actually, we're going to pause for a moment and bring in Ben Noah activist Ron Williams. Let me just see if I can bring him in. I think we're going to bring Ron, good morning.
Good morning, Dennis, you're on there too?
No, Dennis is vacationing up in Vermont. I thought he mentioned he was coming back Sunday, so I'm assuming he's coming back this afternoon. So just right now, Ron, it's just you and I. I know I was hoping we might, and he might be listening in. Thomas Easton from Arkansas, and maybe even Rebecca Vanderwerf from North Carolina might be listening. So I openly welcome you both, blessed souls, as well as perhaps we might get a call from Alabama from Pedro Rivero, but so far you're the only one that's responded. So, Ron, we're talking about the idea, I don't know if you're listening so far to the show, but the program, that the Mishnah says that this world is like a corridor to the future world. Prepare yourself in this corridor so you may enter the banqueting hall to feast in the world to come. Now, we're not talking about a physical smorgasbord, but the sublimating of our energies towards something worthwhile in order that we can access the positive energy that we generated in this world and access via the Torah and the commandments. But yet during this period of living in this corridor of this world, a person can go through suffering. And this type of suffering, the Rebbe says, continues that one will eventually see that whatever suffering we went through, and again, we don't wish any suffering in a human being, but we've all suffered to one extent or another, that we will see that there was a benefit to that suffering. And I just want to get a little tangential. Ben Noah, Ronald Cook from Alabama, posted this, and I want to share with you, Ron, and then I'd like to get your feedback. And it reads like this. It's very, I don't know where he pulled it from. He didn't cite a source, but I think it's very apropos to what we're talking about now. And it reads like this. As I look back on my life, I realize that every time I thought I was being rejected from something good, I was actually being redirected to something better. So, Ron, how do we share with other people the idea that, yes, we are preparing for a better world, the world to come, which we understand as an eternal world, but sometimes there's suffering involved? How do we assist people realize, without judging them for their suffering and not making them feel overwhelmed by the fact they have to accept their suffering as a preparation for good, that in fact it is that very thing that's causing them to suffer is actually elevating them to some extent?
Okay, Donald, I'll start off first by saying the reason I didn't join you in the beginning was I was preparing to leave. I'm actually on an errand for my mother as we speak.
Okay.
So many times I'm not be able to give you the direct sources of certain quotations because I don't have the availability of my books with me.
Okay.
So I might enlist your help for that. In terms of this world being a corridor to the banquet hall of the world to come, we still have to keep in mind that we make this world a dwelling place for the Creator. So
mm-hmm.
our focus has to be kind of both on here and now and also the world to come. The here and now, as in our actions and deeds here, should not only be for the benefit of the world to come, but for our interaction and relationship with our fellow man and the Creator at the same time. Pertaining to those people, to the suffering a person may have to endure, which may redirect his path to that path that is actually the correct one for him, is a person must leave themselves open that we must have the faith that everything God is doing for us is the right thing,
True.
And many times, things that may happen to us that may appear very good may not always lead to such a good end in and of itself, but a direction to something else. Many times, many of us have experienced this in which we got lost looking for a specific address and end up discovering places in which we will visit later, and due to that loss, now we're able to find that address we never really set out on finding to begin with. So the guiding hand of the Creator is with us at all times. The one thing we have to do is be aware of this happening. And nothing in life would actually seem as a real suffering in and of itself, but as something leading to something else. So, off the top of my head, yeah.
Well, at the top of the head, I'm glad to hear there's some good things coming out of the top of your head. So, let me, Ron, how long do you have, by the way, to participate?
I didn't get to my destination as yet, until I get there.
Okay, so may you go 2 miles an hour so you can stand for the rest of the show. Not in traffic, but of your own free will. I'll say 15 miles an hour, as long as you're not on the highway. Okay, so with that being said, let's continue on with the letter of the Rebbe. We're not going to read the whole thing, but another four or five paragraphs. So the Rebbe then goes on to say something which is very important for us to remember, blessed souls, is that it's impossible to describe the joys of life, the joys of the life of the soul in the world to come. For even in this world, and I think we have another coin in this, might be Kartrel Gore. Let me just see who this is. Kartrel, is this you?
Ken. Boker Tov, B'nei Godim. Yom Yom Yepe.
It's been a long time. We have Ron on the line, and Ron, we have Kartrel. Long time since you've been in with us, Kartrel. Glad to have you back.
Thank you. Tada Baba.
We're talking about the idea, Kartrel, which might be a little ethereal to many people. I'd like you to chime in after I read this statement, that the Bhagavad Gita is talking about the idea that people have to go through suffering in this world. And we don't wish suffering on any people, but suffering is a part of the living experience. But at the same time, too, to contrast that, it's impossible to describe the joys of the life of the soul in the world to come. For even in this world, while the soul is connected to the body, its life is on an infinitely higher plane. And how much more so when the soul is longer enmeshed in the body. Now, this brings me to the point which you mentioned many, many times in the program, that the Lubavitch Rebbe was once asked a question in the 1950s by a member of the Young Israel organization, which is an organization, one of its duties is to try to educate unaffiliated Jews or unaware Jews of their heritage, that when he was asked what happens after death, the Rebbe said, I think it's better to restate the phrase, is what happens at the next level of life, which is alluding to what we're talking about here, the world to come, which none of us, I personally cannot describe the world to come, as much as the sages have said, it will be a time of greater delight of the soul, and there's a level where some say that it's the life of the soul without the body, and then it's reunited in the body, and then it will leave the body again, it will always be in the body. The point is, Kartrel, when people talk about the world to come, or let's say any sort of messianic redemption, whether it be for a Jewish or Christian perspective or from your own studies and other faiths, the idea of a messianic time where there will be a higher joy for the soul, do you think people are paying lip service for this, or they're doing some sort of introspective, accounting of themselves? What does that mean for myself now to understand that at one day my soul will be rejoicing in matters much higher than the plane of life that we're living right now?
All right. For Christians, that's a big deal. And the ancient Egyptians thought you could take it with you. So if they were wealthy enough, they had their prize. For example, I purchased a funeral plot for myself and my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And when my mother was buried, the people who sold me the plot said, it's not big enough for two. You have to buy an extra plot.
Mm-hmm.
Or expanded, but that's another story. But anyway, and now I'm thinking about buying another burger plot for myself. I'm no spring chicken. I'm 62 years old. And, well, I'm not going to take along my camcorder or my cell phone or even my driver's license, you know. Just bury me with a nice suit. The ancient Egyptians felt you could take it with you. And so they put the wealthy ones put their prized possessions in their tombs with them. So I guess they did take it with them, but I don't think it did them much good. And the grave robbers were happy that they did so, you know?
Right.
The grave robbers were very happy they took their prized possessions with them.
True, true. Ron, this whole idea of asking people to consider the idea that there's a higher sense of life for the soul in the world to come, how do you remember when you were growing up? I mean, you grew up in the Catholic faith. How was that described to you, or was it described to you, the idea of messianic redemption or the world to come, and how this related to a greater sense of life for the soul of the human being who makes it to the world to come?
Well, you were actually given the example of the resurrection. Honestly speaking, I really never focused much on that aspect. It was more or less, you know, making sure you visit Mass 3 times, you know, in the 6 o'clock in the afternoons after school or after work, and you listen to the service conducted by the priest, basically. Very
right.
Ritualistic in terms of, you know, the incense, the prayers they say and everything, but studying of the afterlife and this, I really never, you know, maybe paid much attention to, you know.
I hear you saying. Ron, I think, and Cartrell, we have another guest calling in. Would this be Rebecca Vanderwerth of North Carolina or Thomas Easton of Arkansas?
This is Rebecca.
Rebecca, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, I get. By the way, Rebecca, let me. You've already, I think, dialogued with Ron Williams, but I don't think you've dialogued with Booker T. Washington Business League President Cartrell Gore, who was a public servant here in New York City as a truant officer, and also he's involved in trying to empower people of all ages, of different backgrounds, to try to find business solutions and economic solutions to make New York City a better place to live. So, Rebecca, I just want to introduce you to Cartrell. Cartrell, Rebecca, and then
good
Ron,
morning.
Say hello to Rebecca.
Good morning. Good morning.
And Ron?
Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning, Ron.
Okay. So, Rebecca, if you've been listening in, you know, you are of the Christian faith. How is the world to come, how has it been taught to you, and the idea of a higher life for the soul, has that matter not been discussed in your faith?
No, it has been discussed.
Okay.
It has been taught, but remember, too, I'm also Jewish. Don't count me out on that one. So I'm one of the, one of those.
Okay.
But, you know, it's been taught that without the spirit of Hashem, there's really no way that you can change or alter the way you think or live your life.
Right.
And that his word is what teaches you, which, of course, is the Torah, and that it is only by his spirit that you can really experience a connection with him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I have to say, it's the more I spend time with him, the more I spend time in his word, the more I spend time in prayer, the closer I do feel to him.
Mm-hmm. I validate everything that you just said. I mean, that's the more, you know, the more we engage in anything, how much more so with the Creator, we develop a sense of sensitivity of who we are. We're never going to figure out Creator totally, but from
right.
time to time, hopefully even on a daily basis, he'll give us a molecule of new consciousness which can nourish us for the next day and beyond. With that being said, I'd like to finish up this letter by the Rebbe, going back to the idea of a childlike consciousness, which unfortunately too many adults immerse themselves in and try to, how do we get to the next level of consciousness and not just stay big rooted in a childlike perception of joy and excitement. As the Rebbe mentions, compare the joy and excitement of a child when he receives a tasty candy with the joy of a very wise and learned scientist who succeeds in resolving an important scientific problem. Here again, as stated before, there is some connection between the child and the scientist. Excuse me. For everything is relative. For in so much as life on this earth and the life of the soul in the future world are concerned, the differences are not of degree but of kind, and there is no common denominator between the two whatsoever. At the same time, too, it should be remembered that the suffering in the corridor, which is no more than a corridor leading to the banqueting hall, as we mentioned before, is a temporary one only, whereas the gain is eternal. Of course, as the Rebbe concluded this part of the letter, of course you may ask why things should be arranged, that one must give up something in order to gain something greater, but this would be the same as a child asking why should he give up his outdoor pleasures, as we mentioned before, that the child must stay in school in order to get the basics and the fundamentals of education, but surely so it is not an unkindness for the child to be, so to speak, deprived of getting fresh air, but rather if they stay in school, eventually they will get to the point where they will appreciate their educational process, secular or spiritual or faith-based, and eventually enjoy even more so with greater gratitude that they're outdoors where they like to be when they were younger. And the Rebbe concluded this point of the letter, I trust that the above will suffice to answer your question. So my question, I guess I'll turn to Rebecca first and we'll go to Cartrell and Ron. The idea of educating or assisting people realizing that there is a greater good that we should strive for, and then it might seem at some level there's suffering, whether intellectually, emotionally, there might even be a little bit of financial loss by taking the time to volunteer or do good or do something, as opposed to them just wanting instant gratification. What have you found, Rebecca, is a potent means of encouraging people to, so to speak, go through that period where they're giving up something of themselves in order to get a greater gain in terms of the quality of their life and connection with God and people?
Morning.
Well, are you talking to me first, or I'm sorry?
Yeah, you. I'm asking you first. Okay.
What I have experienced, and it's taken me a while to get to this point, is when I've tried to do things my way, that's when I suffer the most. When I finally sit down and say, okay, I don't know what to do here. I'm just going to totally commit everything that I need to do into your hands and let you guide me. That's when everything starts to smooth out. And I've realized we've been given free will. Mm-hmm. Now, we can do it our way, but we are going to suffer the consequences of it. Mm-hmm. When we get to the point of learning how to completely trust in Him and put everything that we do, say, and think into His hands, that's whenever we can start walking according to His will and the path that He has laid out for us. You know how much I love King David.
Mm-hmm.
I look back on what he said. You knew me before I was formed in the womb.
Mm-hmm.
You already knew everything that I was going to do from the moment mm-hmm. I took my first breath to the moment I took my last breath. So mm-hmm. he already has a plan laid out for us. We just have to get to that point of acknowledging the fact that he is in control. He knows what he's doing. And if we just allow him to take control, our lives will be much more fulfilled, much greater, and much happier, even when bad things happen.
Beautiful. Cartrell, what methods have you had in your, by the way, and may you have a blessing to 120, 62, or 63, whatever you mentioned is not really that old anymore. May you have many, many, may you go into the triple digits and beyond that. The idea of educating other people by example or by speech if they want to dialogue with us, the idea of giving up of oneself, which might for some people be perceived as suffering, for the greater good, which actually, if one seeks the greater good, one actually is doing good to oneself.
That is true. People tend to remember you for your good deeds. And as a person in the field of education, or even in the business world, I mean, sometimes you have to sacrifice short-term pleasure for long-term reward.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that I learned, not just in education, but when I worked for corporate America, you know.
Right.
I mean, like, sometimes you study for when you're young in school, you study. You can't go out and play, you have to study for your next exam. or in the business world, you have to study for your license exam or
right.
prepare for your next promotion. And some advice that I got today says you should be thankful for what you have, and you'll end up having more. But if you concentrate on what you don't have, you will never have enough.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
You do the things that way.
Beautiful. Ron, your take on this, on how can we, if someone, if you encounter someone and they're saying, why should I make the sacrifice or do an extra good or contribute my free time, how do we share with them that there is, in fact, something else much better coming down the pipeline for them and their loved ones if they engage in that greater good? And before you answer, Ron, I just want to, we have, Baruch Hashem, Danga, we have another guest caller calling in. Let's see who this may be. Yes, blessed soul caller, can you identify yourself and where you're calling in from?
Reb Don, it's Rabbi Ariel Nachman.
Wow, Rabbi Nachman. Wow. this is wow, we have a real smorgasbord. You know, we talked about a banquet hall to have Rebecca and Ron and Cartrell and you. I feel like I'm in the banquet hall already. Before you go on, Rabbi Nachman, I just want Ron to respond, then I'll ask you the question as well if you've been listening in. Ron, could you please give your point of view?
All right, Don, I mean, I have to run in a second, but I would like to say this before I leave. They said that for a seed to actually grow and sprout into a whole new plant, it must suffer disintegration in the earth. I mean, I use the word suffer because also when we pass on to that new level of life, as the Rebbe says, but after 120, we
right.
also suffer that disintegration. But there is a new life that we continue to. Also, Rebecca mentioned something interesting when she said that even though we have free will, and
right.
I read, Don, you're going to have to help me with the source of this, that when you make the will of the Creator your will, he makes the will of others your will.
Yeah.
I don't.
Rabbi Nachman, that sounds like from Perkei Avos, doesn't it?
It does sound that way, yes.
All right, yeah. Thank you so much. Anyways, Don, I'm going to check out for a second, and I'll be back in as soon as I start driving again.
Okay, Ron, thank you.
All right.
So
you're welcome.
We'll turn to, thank you, and we'll turn to Rabbi Nachman. Rabbi Nachman, we're talking about the idea of the greater good, and that sometimes people get kind of bent out of shape intellectually, mentally, spiritually. Even their faith gets knocked a little bit when they suffer in this world. But, you know, we're trying to offer some sort of feedback for any of the blessed souls listening out there, that how can we educate people that the suffering is temporary, but from what can be gleaned from it is for a greater good, as well as sublimating their sense of their own egocentric drives to a better sense of community, you know, for their family and their intimate community that's surrounding them within their Dalet Alma, so to speak, that they will come out much far better ahead by realizing they're just in the corridor and they're heading towards the banquet hall of a greater bliss for the soul. And again, there is an opinion that holds that eventually soul and body will be an eternal configuration, not just a temporary one in the world to come.
Well, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov taught that every fall is a preparation for the next higher ascent.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that I think of it is that when you climb the mountain and you reach the top of the mountain, there's nowhere else to go. You see the next higher mountain from there, and the only way to get to the next higher mountain is to descend from the mountain that you're on.
I like that.
So Rabbi Nachman talked a lot about falling from his position and coming to the understanding that each fall was in purpose to prepare him for the next higher ascent.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as, you know, the age-old question of why do good people suffer or why do we suffer in this world, again, we have to go back to the Talmud and Remember that the rabbis tell us that judgments levied in this world cannot be levied in the next world. And I have said it many times to my congregation is, God, please punish me in this world, because it is only temporary. I would much rather have my corrections in this world than in the next world.
Ooh, that's a brave assertion. And how have the congregants responded when you've taught that this teaching to them?
Well, yeah, it's kind of human nature, and we all go through that, and even I go through it. You know, we go through periods of sickness and stuff like that, and we say that, why me? The old why me, right?
Right.
And I keep going back to Rabbi Zusia and the story of Rabbi Dov Ber, who sent one of his Talmidim, his students, who came to him and asked him the question, why do people suffer in this world? You know, why do good people suffer in this world? He sent him to Reb Zusia, and Reb Zusia was just absolutely confounded by this question. Now, if we've read the stories of Reb Zusia, we know that he was like the ultimate schlemazel, right?
He lived in abject poverty. I do know that. He lived in very oppressive, poverty-stricken conditions.
And every possible thing that could go wrong for this man went wrong for him. I mean, you know, if he was walking down the street, some guy would take it into his head to push him into the mud.
Right.
You know, and that was just his life. And when this student came to him and asked him, he says, first of all, he says, I don't think you have the right person. You know, obviously, Reb Dov Ber is thinking of somebody else. And he says, no, he told me to go to Zusia of Annapolis. And he says, you know, for the life of me, he says, I'm going to have to send you back to the Rebbe because nothing bad has happened in my life. because he understood that everything that happened to him was for his own good.
Beautiful. Yes. Thank you, Rabbi, for that. I love Reb Zusia. Reb Zusia, it happens to be my middle name. So, I think sometimes when people have names named after individuals in our history, they kind of have an inclination to learn about them, have an affinity to them. And I know that Reb Zusia, he is a seminal figure, not only in the history of the students of the Maggid of Mezrich, who was the successor to the Baal Shem Tov, but he was very pivotal in giving a personal recommendation for the printing and the distribution of the Alter Rebbe, the Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi's seminal work called the Tanya, which Rabbi Manus Friedman in our generation recommends for every human being to read, because it's a matter which emphasizes from the verse in Deuteronomy that the matter is not far off from you, but is very close to you indeed, meaning the Almighty Creator's instructions found in Torah, whether it be written or oral instructions, are something which are accessible to a human being's life. That being said, we've basically come a little past the halfway, and earlier this week, or late last week, I should say, Rebecca sent me a wonderful song called Mercy Me, and I thought maybe, Rebecca, would you like to introduce this song before I play it? It doesn't say who is the author of the song, who plays it, but maybe you'd like to introduce
it. Actually, Mercy Me is the group.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
I see. Do you know, where are they based?
Well, they are in the United States. They sing contemporary Christian music, but the song is focused on the Creator and the created.
Right. And that is why I'm choosing to play it, because it's an affirmation of the sovereignty of the Creator. I don't want anyone to misunderstand what my intentions are, because if you hear the lyrics, which are very clear, it's talking about He has us under His control, meaning the Creator and no one else. So this is a 4-minute and 11-second song, and enjoy, and then we'll come back, and then I'm going to be sharing some teachings from Rambam. Hold on, everyone, for the next 4 minutes and 11 seconds. Was Mercy Me and You, which I think was that group's way of affirming the oneness of the Creator. And now we'd like to move on to some, because it's normally part of our program to share teachings from Rambam, I'd like to take another means by which to share the information of Rambam. There is someone at work which came out several years now, I think it's about 5 years now, by Rav Moshe Wiener, who it's called the Divine Code, which delineates the seven Noahide commandments. And within the obligation of any one of the nations to know their commandments, that will include, in fact, their obligation to learn what their commandments are. And with embedded within that, Rav Wiener mentions that one of the member of the nations is allowed to learn, and this is, I think, controversial in certain circles, to learn any portion of the Torah which will explain what is the nature of a Jew, what is our commandments, what are our obligations. But I think this is a very important point that Rav Wiener has stressed, because it basically opens up the information. We are living in the age of information. And again, I had hoped someone was going to come on to the program today who was claiming that we Jews are closing the doors on people that want to convert. And again, I want to be very, very clear and say I am not in the business of converting anyone, but sharing with them Torah information as a Torah activist. So I'd like to read a couple of commandments and also how the Rambam has arranged the Mishneh Torah, which is one of the books that Rav Wiener recommends for any human being to learn, to again to understand what are in fact the obligations of Israel and what are the obligations of the children of Noah, and so the children of Noah can understand better how we are configured according to Torah. So I'm just going to read briefly how Rambam himself describes the first book that he wrote, which is called Sefer Hamada, or the Book of Knowledge, and it reads as follows. I will include within it, this is the Rambam, I'm reading a translation that he wrote, Rambam, I will include within it all the commandments that are the foundations of the faith taught by Moses, our teacher, of blessed memory, those which a person must know before everything, like, for example, the unity of God, blessed be he, and the prohibition against worshipping false gods. I have called this book the Book of Knowledge. And I'm going to read how he delineates the commandments which are connected to this portion of the book. The first of the positive commandments is the commandment to know that there is a God, as stated in Exodus 20, verse 2, quote, and you shall love God your Lord, to unify him, as it says in Deuteronomy 6, 4, which says, God is our Lord, God is one, that's the famous Shema prayer that many people are aware of, to love him, as stated in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5, as it states, and you shall love God your Lord, to fear him, as written in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 13, states, fear God your Lord, to pray, as it's stated in Exodus 23, verse 25, states, quote, and you shall serve God your Lord, and Rambam tersely states, this service of serving Creator is to pray to him, to cling to him, as is written in Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 2, as it says, and you shall cling to him, and to swear in his name, as it says in Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 20, and you shall swear in his name, to imitate his good and just ways, as it says in Deuteronomy chapter 28, 19, and you shall walk in his ways, to sanctify his name, as it says in Leviticus 22, 32, Leviticus chapter 22, verse 32 states, quote, and I shall be sanctified amongst the children of Israel. With that being said, I'd like to turn to Rebecca, if you don't mind. We have Ron back on the line. Now, first of all, number one, I just listed 10 commandments. Now, these are not all of these commandments are, in fact, listed in the 10 commandments, which the world is associating with the entirety of the Bible, the five books of Moses. So let me ask you this. How do you feel, Rebecca, and then we're going to ask the rabbi a very important question. Ron Williams, thank you for coming back on. How do you feel, Rebecca, when people learn that the 10 commandments are not just the only 10 commandments in the Bible, and that the doors are open for them to learn more about what the Bible and the five books of Moses is about, the Chumash or the Torah, you want to say? And so not only can they learn what are their obligations, but they can better understand what the obligations are for the Jewish people, and hopefully to understand that if they want to say, for instance, understand their as if a person of Christian faith wants to understand who they understand as the Messiah is, that he had to be someone that followed these commandments, because Messiah never came, as we understand in our tradition, or will understand when we await the speedy arrival, as we understand Messiah. Messiah is not coming to break any commandments or to say they're no longer void, but to reveal to us matters that have not been revealed to the greatest prophets of all ages, going back to even Adam and Noah and Abraham and Moses. It's a deep question.
Well, no, I mean, and I agree with you 100%. of course, I'm not going to go into detail what it is because you know I run a website that incorporates Torah and Christian belief.
Right.
And my main focus is to help people to understand that the Torah, the law, everything that was established by Hashem is our guideline. That is the original footnote. We are not to stem away from it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I do believe the Messiah has already come, but
okay.
I do reiterate the fact that he did not come to dispel the law. He came to fulfill it. We are still under the law. We are still to obey the commandments that Hashem has laid down before us. And if there's additional teaching that's in there that is not listed, as you stated, in the Bible, I want that incorporated as well. Because this is what was laid down for us to live by. And if we're not receiving the whole truth and the whole word of what he laid down, that I feel as though our lives are not being completely fulfilled by what he has established for us.
Beautiful. Rabbi Nachman, I'd like to turn to you. And again, thank you for coming back on, Ron and Cartrell. Rabbi, are we Jews, Rabbi Nachman, are we as a Jewish people guilty of closing the doors upon the nations of the world at this time I'm speaking about, precluding their opportunities to grow spiritually, whether they want to convert or to keep the seven Noahide commandments that were originally transmitted to Adam and then Noah and retransmitted to Moses at Mount Sinai?
I believe
it's a heavy question.
I believe that the doors are starting to open again.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time, as we know, during the Middle Ages and during the Inquisition and stuff like that, that laws throughout Europe and stuff against Judaizing and rabbis and stuff were thrown in prison. And that kind of forced us to close the doors for that time because it was actually dangerous. And that's
mm-hmm.
that goes into a lot of other things, a lot of other traditions that we have now that were done to protect people, protect women, and so on and so forth. But the doors are starting to open again. And they may be slowly opening, but they are indeed opening.
True. What would you say to any Jew who might be listening to this program, why they should have less trepidation in dialoguing with anyone of the human family experience about what their obligations are and be very transparent about what our obligations are? Because, again, according to Rav Wiener's halachic decision, that the Noahides are allowed to learn what our responsibilities are as human beings, as members of the Jewish nation.
Well, I agree with Reb Wiener as far as, it's not everyone is intended to be a Jew. And How would I want to put this? It is a tough road to hoe. When you talk about the seven Noahide commandments and you compare that to the 613, which encompasses everything that we do, I mean, it is a very daunting task to take that on if you've come from a background where that hasn't been the case. And, of course, we have a lot of examples of people who have done it very successfully.
Mm-hmm.
Rabbi Akiva, for one, his father
That's
was
right.
a convert, and we have Ruth, who came in voluntarily and converted and married Boaz, who comes from who descended from another convert, and
right.
who brought us the Davidic line.
Right. The Messiah will come through Ruth.
Yes.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Rabbi. Ron, you're right. You know, I know you and I have had many discussions about the obligations of the children of Noah. And as I understand, maybe you want to elaborate on this, there's actually the option of the children of Noah to choose for the sake of getting reward more commandments than these seven, because seven are just basically like a core number, just like Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai are a core number, which branch out to 613. So the seven commandments actually branch out to more than seven. Isn't that correct, Ron?
Yeah, that's actually correct, because the seven are more or less general commandments. Hello?
Right. Yes, yes. So, what are the commandments?
Could
you share some examples to your knowledge of what are the commandments that Ben Noah can opt to integrate within his or her life, and in fact should be hopefully rejoicing in the fact that by doing so they're bringing more blessings into their life?
Well, first I'd like to address a point you just made when you said that they can opt for more commandments for the sake of reward.
Right.
That may also sound like more or less like an opportunistic kind of approach. Even though that is the fact, I would like to say that it can be viewed as every mitzvah that we keep, actually, we form a connection to the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
So opting for more observing more commandments is actually just creating more of a connection to the Creator, as opposed to just looking at it from a reward aspect only. And I will more or less tell you the commandments which we are not allowed to keep, because everything else basically is up for grabs, as they say. We're not allowed to affix the mezuzahs. We're not allowed to keep Shabbat. And also wear a tefillin, the phylacteries worn on a Jewish male of age 13 and onwards. But everything else, basically, according to my teacher, who you know, Rabbi Yaakov Rogalski, and the book he authored, Path of the Righteous Gentile, basically the Noahides, they're allowed to observe. So,
Excuse me.
Yes.
Excuse me. I think you made four prohibitions for Noahides. I cannot wear the tassels. I cannot fix the mezuzah. That's what you're saying?
Not the tassels, the tinsels, the tefillin. Sorry if I made that mistake. The tefillin, yes.
Yeah.
And the mezuzah also.
Correct.
Karcha, what is your take on these matters that now that the information is out there, and since we're living in the age of information, let me ask you this: Are people who are of the nations of the world, do they have a trepidation to learn this information, Karcha, to learn more about what you know the Torah has to say about their heritage, which is also blessed? Because if we go back to chapter 9, verse 1, in the book of Genesis, we see that when Noah and his three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, left the boat, the ark, they were all blessed by God.
And one was cursed by Noah.
Well, that's for a future show, and by and large, the branch of Ham is an extinct people according to Rambam now. So there's no curse on Ham right now, as far as I understand, because the branch, basically his fourth son was cursed. But that's again for a future show. But I recently heard a preacher speaking about the removal of the curse. The curse is not there, as far as I understand. Because it was only one branch that had been cursed, and again, Rambam writes that they are an extinct people now. I'm going to bring in also. We're adding to our banquet is Thomas Easton of Arkansas. Thomas, good morning.
Good morning, Don. How are you?
Thank God. And I just want to just we have Rebecca Vanderwerth of North Carolina. We have Rabbi Nachman of is it Minnesota, Rabbi?
Michigan.
Michigan, I'm sorry, and we have Ron and Cartrell Gore of the New York City area, and then hopefully Thomas. Hopefully I'm going to connect you to Ron for future studies as well. Thomas, I don't know how much you've been listening, but would you like to chime in on this age of information? Is there any fear on the part of the children of Noah, meaning anyone who is not Jewish, to learn about this information? Perhaps it might cause them a certain fear that they've not been given their other heritage, which is really a dutiful right for any human being to learn about the story of creation and how all the families of the earth are intermingled from that initial seminal family of Noah and his three sons who were blessed by God coming out of the ark.
Well, I don't think on my behalf that there's any trepidation. I think it's each individual's responsibility to sit down and study what commandments they think applies to them for full instruction. I know there are many differing views on what exactly the children of Noah can and cannot do. There are teachers out there, Rabbi David Katz of the spot, that teach a different level of those not born into the children of Israel, that one goes through different stages, and Noahide being one of those that accept the seven laws because they were commanded by God, not through their own rationalizing. But then there are stages past that. He continually teaches on the path of the Ger, someone who is different from just a Noahide, in that they can accept, if they wish, any of the 613.
I hear you. With that being said, and now that, you know, Baruch Hashem, we have five co-hosts. I guess the cherry on top would be if somehow Dennis would call in, but I gather he's not going to do it for this program. I want to turn to a little bit of Rabbi Nachman Chassidus. And the concept we'll be sharing is from a book called Erech HaPaim, which means literally long in anger, or basically talking about the attribute of patience. And we're going to deal with this idea of patience as it relates to the concept of peace in one's household. Now, part of the peace of one's household, if one has children, is to give them the proper attention that they should not feel as if they are being neglected, and in some case they might even feel abused, if they are constant witnesses to argumentation and, you know, verbal violence between father and mother, mother and father. And when, in the case where, how much more so when, say, like the father runs from the house, whether it be a divorce or just leaving the marriage in shambles, leaves a terrible, an evil impression upon all the days of their life, and the children grow up with a sense of being left, what in the term is in Hebrew is called hefker, like, so to speak, left is like a, I guess a way to explain it in more than one word, is to be, sense, they feel like a feather in the wind. And in the end, it could be that their children will mimic the behaviors, unfortunately, that they might see committed by their parents, and even worse, they can live a life of evil with stealing and robbery and inappropriate behaviors between man and woman, and they basically could wind up in jail because of a dysfunctional situation in the parental household. And I myself witnessed that, unfortunately, in a place in Israel called Beit Dagan, which is close to a moshav called Kfar Chabad, where unfortunately the Yemenite community was seriously damaged, spiritually, emotionally, intellectually, and even economically, by then the fledgling Zionist state of Israel, where in this Beit Dagan, it had such insanity that when the police would be chasing the Yemenite drug dealers, the Jewish police chasing the Jewish Yemenite drug dealers, and the only sense of solace would be when the Yemenite Jews would steal some sense of heritage, would stop in the Chabad house and put on tefillin, would leave, and then the police would come later on in the day to look for them and ask the rabbi, who was a friend of mine, Shmuel Gruber, if they had seen such and such a person. So this was, at that particular time, it was caused, unfortunately, by the state of Israel. But we're talking about on a more personal level, the argumentation between, and the jabbing of each other verbally between parents, which can destroy the peace in the household. It's not just something which is taking place on the existential level, on the intergenerational level. So I'd like to go around the and unfortunately I'd like to ask everyone to keep their comments to like say like 2 minutes, because we are coming to the rapidly coming to the end of the show, and I do want to cover something Chabad Chassidus and then about the verse we wanted to cover from Genesis 4:15. So I'll start off with Cartrell. I mean, you probably, from the truants you deal with, probably a lot of them are coming from homes where there's a lot of argumentation or the father has left the home. Any comments on that? And do you see firsthand the damage of children, unfortunately, who are born into this situation?
I have seen all sorts of different combinations and permutations. I mean, I had two little girls once, and I could only deal with the grandmother because these two girls, they had two mothers and three fathers, if you can imagine that.
Right.
I could only deal with the grandmother because grandma
right.
makes sense to me.
Right.
Grandma makes sense to me. The other stuff, I couldn't really wrap my mind around.
Right.
But like, what can I say? There are so many different things that I have seen that I mean, you could have a family with two working parents, two work-educated parents.
Right.
But if the child has some kind of deficiency, those parents are in denial. It can't be my child. I have
right.
a master's degree. My child cannot be slow. I've seen that also. I think that's the worst. When the parent is an educated person and cannot accept the fact that their child has some kind of problem,
mm-hmm.
and they make excuses
mm-hmm.
for it, they're in denial. So that's the worst
cool.
thing. That's the worst that bothers me, because I expect to see that there the least, but I do see it.
True. Rabbi Nachman, I'd like to ask you, I'm sure you have many years either from speaking from the pulpit on this issue or your interactions with your congregation and your years just being in the rabbinical field. I mean, you've probably seen the firsthand damage, and what approaches have you found successful in trying to repair this wound of lack of peace in the house to the point where it affects the children?
Well, it's I go back to the Torah, where it talks about, Hashem tells us that, you know, to visit the sins of the father unto the third and fourth generation.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that Hashem does not punish the innocent. No man can pay for the sins of another man.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not a curse. It's not a punishment. But what it is a warning to parents that if you stray from the path, your children will stray from the path. Their children will stray from the path
mm-hmm.
unto the third or the fourth generation. At that point, we start seeing, as we see with many Baal Teshuvah, is that they have been third or fourth generation, and when they return with a vengeance.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Is to understand what this verse is trying to tell us is that we have to be very careful about in our dealing with our home life, because what we do at home will be perpetrated to 2, 3, and 4 generations.
Mm-hmm. That hopefully will cause a person to do a little bit of engage in a little bit of, or not a little, a lot of thought on how to avoid, hopefully, negative occurrences for their future progeny or their present children in the house. Rebecca, I know you're a mother and a grandmother. I'm sure these teachings are, you know, you've seen everything. The good and the bad, the sweet and everything else. And what, with grandmotherly wisdom, what would you offer to our blessed listeners about taking heed towards maintaining peace in the house?
Well, there's a couple of different things that run through my mind. I think about what it says in the Torah about the thorns. The thorns were referring to people that were of an ungodly nature in many cases. Who we associate ourselves with plays a role as well as, you know, in the things that our children are influenced by, even some of the programs that are on television. people don't stop to think of some of the subliminal messages that are being sent, including incorporation of witchcraft into a child's mind. You know, there's just, we need to be extremely mindful of what we are allowing our children to be exposed to. I'm even to the point, I'm so overprotective, I'm talking to my children about making sure the grandchildren are in private schools or being homeschooled because I'm trying so hard to keep them from being influenced by the world. But the main thing is, and, you know, the Israeli way of life was established, I mean, that is our, it just really bothers me to think that stuff like this is going on in Israel, because I look at Israel as being, you know, our guideline for peace, love, hope, unity, and to see that kind of stuff come into Israel really, really does bother me a lot. But that, the whole premise was the father teaching the children and the mother being the nurturer. And when you have that sound structure in your household, yes, your kids are going to experiment from time to time, but they're always going to revert back their original teaching. And as long as they have a sound structured home where they have somebody there to say, hey, pull back on the ropes, I'm not going to let you go in that direction, you stand a better chance of having a household that stays together instead of breaking apart.
Thank you. Thomas, you are raising two teenagers. I know as someone who has what my oldest daughter who has graduated from teenagehood to young adulthood and now a son who became a teenager, and my daughter, according to Jewish law, is a young woman, even though she's still in her 12th year. What's your advice towards anyone out listening there? Because you are on the courageous path of not just learning about the seven Noahic commandments, but you've told me before that your 14 and 16-year-old are also engaged, especially your daughter. And how do you go about guiding them in a way that, you know, listen, parents make mistakes, but we also do a lot of good things. You're doing the greatest good for your children possible by exposing them and encouraging them to follow in such a path.
Hello?
Well,
I'd like to
Carter, I'd just like to hear from Thomas, and then you can chime in, and then we'll get to Ron. Yes, Thomas.
Well, all I can offer is this. I certainly don't have all the answers, but I think when you return to Torah value,
mm-hmm.
and that is the root of your family tree, I think it's very, very hard to get knocked over in a storm. And I know that's kind of trying to make it more poetic than it needs to be, but teenagers, just like adults in our today's society, we're so susceptible to all the ills that plague us. When you look around society and you see so much teenage pregnancy and so much drug addiction and so much family relationships that are in dire straits, I think it's because we've moved away from Torah values,
mm-hmm.
and only by returning to Torah values are we going to straighten it out. My children, Baruch Hashem, are just as wonderful as they could be. I couldn't ask for anything more. Not that they don't make mistakes, not that I don't make mistakes, but
right.
In the end, we're in it together. God leads us, we follow, and that's the answer to it all.
Thank you, Thomas. Cartrell, what did you want to add, please?
Well, today I saw a slogan that I might put on my stationery, and it goes like this. You spend years wishing that your parents would get off your back, and when you grow up, you are grateful that they had your back.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Yes.
Dennis, I mean, Ron, I'm sorry, you are an uncle to, I don't know the number, but I know more than one niece or nephew. The premium, I know from knowing your mother and knowing you, and meeting your sister briefly at our son's bar mitzvah, that I know that your family cherishes shalom, peace. And what would be the advice you give as someone, basically, you're sort of like a patriarch in your household, fulfilling so nobly the role unfortunately, that your father left at a premature age because of a shooting over 20 years ago, how would you promote the idea of the primacy, the premium value of promoting shalom and pleasant talk in the household?
Well, one of the things are is that our home is of an extended family, and even back home, that majority of families were like that due to the economic state of the country. And what you have is that when both parents leave for work, many times children are left to their own devices, and teenagers. Thank God, my mother was always home, so she's able to look over the grandkids when they come home from school.
Mm-hmm.
And many times we forsake the elderly. You know, we put them into retirement homes too quickly, or leave them on their own. But they have so much value to bring to a family that I feel that's a mistake here in America, where, you know, the elderly is always shoved basically on the back burners. Man, they have so much wisdom and experience to offer, not only us, as they did, but our children. So, and women also. Many times women play the most essential role in terms of educating a child, because due to the fact that they're original nurturers of the child, they can impart such wisdom that it's basically, you know, it stays forever with the child.
Right.
So, you know, I just think that when we start in our dating processes, that's where we have to be very careful to make sure that our values and that of our future spouses match. Because when you don't, then you can have the bickering which enters into the family life upon the children, and it causes immense damage to the child. And at the young age, exposed to that, many times, not only mimic that behavior, but sometimes we are so traumatized by it, we are afraid to enter relationships ourselves.
Okay.
True. Thank you, Ron. Now we're going to move on to some...
I have to run again, so thank you all, and thank you so much for all the co-hosts today. You guys have made it so, so wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on.
And I appreciate your input. It was awesome.
Thank you so much.
I just want to add that I remember a scriptural verse that I'm told pertains to marriage. I do not remember whether it's Old Testament or New Testament, but I'll tell it to you anyway.
Right.
Do not be unevenly yoked.
I'm sorry, say that again, please.
Do not be unevenly yoked.
Unevenly yoked. The last two words I'm not understanding.
Unevenly. Yoked. Y-O-K-E-D.
What is that? I'm not. What is that implying? Unevenly woke. I mean, just too passionate. I don't know. What is the implication?
I think what he's referring to is that where it the Torah commandment that not to yoke an ox with a donkey.
Yes.
Because it causes pain to one or the other.
Uh huh.
Yes.
So that has, you're saying, Coach, you understand that as applying to the marriage scenario, which I can agree with.
Yes. Yeah. The yoke is not even.
Right. Okay.
It causes a lot of discourse and strife.
Right.
Yes.
Is that
Old or New Testament, by the way?
As it applies to marriage, Rabbi Nachman, maybe you can comment. I don't recall. That sounds, if it's applicable to a marriage scenario, it would seem to me applied to an oral Torah tradition. I don't recall scripture equating a marriage relationship to having an uneven yoke. That would be probably more related to Jewish laws related to marriage relationships. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it would probably be a reference from that, or it might even be in the commentaries of Rashi.
Yeah.
Compare it to like when Moses. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Rebecca.
And just compare it to when Moses, when his first wife died, and he married again.
Right.
Miriam, you know, they were looking at like, you know, this is somebody from a pagan background that he's marrying, but she decided to connect with his God, and that would have been considered unevenly yoked otherwise, because she was of a completely different belief system.
Well, Tzipora was the daughter of the high priest of Midian, who actually shed his idolatrous beliefs, and actually, according to the oral Torah tradition, he actually converted and became an Israelite convert. With that being said, I'd like to share a little bit of a Chabad Hasidus from the 5th Lubavitch Rebbe. It's called Conscious Mayan, which is basically extracting out teachings from the inner dimension of Torah as it relates to a prophetic teaching in the book of Joel, chapter 4, verse 18. A wellspring shall go forth from the house of God and shall water the valley of Shittim. Now, here in the discourse tour in chapter 1, the 5th Lubavitch Rebbe, Rabbi Shalom Dovber, states the following, and then we'll go around the table for feedback and comments and concerns, of course, by our co-host today. So it says, vigor of the animal soul actually, so to speak, sucks away the energy of the quintessential soul of the human being. As there's a statement that if the body is going to dominate, it's going to subordinate the soul. So that means strengthening the materiality of the animal soul, again, weakens a person's quintessential soul, and the effects can take many forms. A person can become estranged from Torah study and the service of the heart, which we talked about before, is referring to prayer. A person can become incapable of comprehending any concept as it relates to the nature of godliness, which is written openly in the Psalms and the five books of Moses and the prophets and, of course, in the oral Torah traditions. And a person loses the ability to meditate, to get into cognitive perceptions and sense a godly concept to the depths of his or her soul, to arouse his or her soul to cleave to God and merge with the Almighty Creator. And all of these more refined ideas of clinging to the Creator through prayerful meditations become absolutely, ultimately irrelevant to him or her because they are so sunken in their animal desires. But the effects go even farther, go much deeper. A person ceases to fear God and becomes oblivious to God's wish and presence. A person can ultimately just simply forget about the Creator. God forbid, may everyone be spared this type of bitter type of consciousness. The fact that a certain act or object may be contrary to God's will not deter him or her from doing what he or she wants. God and God's will then become not felt within him or her, and that to the point where they might be affected by not doing God's will. By no means does this person deny God in his Torah. This type of person knows that the Torah is truth and that what he wishes is forbidden by the Torah. Nevertheless, he or she fails to sense within him or herself that this is evil, that they lack an awareness that can prevent him or herself from succumbing to evil, that which can enable him to resist his or her lust. I mean, this is a very moralistic teaching, but I feel it is my duty as a Torah activist to share such a teaching to remind people that even though we might be permissible to say eat certain foods, be careful, if we overdo it, we might be redirecting such pure, pristine energy of our quintessential soul into just fueling the fire of our animal soul and eventually follow down this bitter path that the Fifth Rebbe was talking about. I'd like to start with Rabbi Nachman. Your views on this teaching?
Well, you know, when we talk about the three main components that we operate in this corporal existence with the soul, the nefesh, the ruach, and then the neshama, I liken the ruach to a balance switch on a speaker's.
Mm-hmm.
If you turn it in one direction, the more you turn it in that direction, the less you're going to hear from one speaker and more you're going to hear it out of the other speaker. If you turn it more and more towards nefesh, towards the animalistic part of the soul, that is what you're going to hear, and the neshoma is going to fade so much into the background that you don't hear it.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have, if you turn it all the way to neshoma, then you don't have the wherewithal for the fight or flight mentality that we need to survive. So it's a very tricky thing to make that balance and know when that balance has to be more towards nefesh and more towards neshoma.
True. So, I mean, it is a trial and error experience, as I believe Thomas mentioned, that he's not perfect and his children are perfect. I got good news for you, Thomas. None of us are except Almighty God. So it's basically, you know, everyone has a certain curiosity within themselves as it relates to even good things and things which are neutral and things which are negative things. And we pray, you know, for the Most High's graces that when we experiment in the negative, that we can correct ourselves almost immediately or have someone who can help us correct ourselves without having to undo too much, to get too much involved in what is known as damage control or collateral damage, I mean, hurting ones outside of ourselves. And hopefully we should be successful in doing this. Rebecca, this idea of people indulging in matters which can kind of coarsen their consciousness, is this something that you think people are thinking about? Or is just, you know, because we live in such a even though the economy is still a little shaky in the land of good and plenty, so to speak, not just talking about those candies, that people kind of like, eh, what's the difference? I might as well enjoy myself now.
Well, I look at it as we have entered into a world of self-gratification. There was a time whenever people lived their life, you know, according to the principles and the guidelines, you know, good nature, and people cared about each other. But we have just grown into time. And you know, I am a true believer that we are in the last days, that we are in the time the Messiah is coming. And that's why the world is becoming the way that it is. Because, it, you know, it tells us, and again, this is in the New Testament, in Revelation, that people will become lovers of self.
Mm-hmm.
Mother will rise against son. Father will rise against daughter. It's going to be what is wrong is right and what's right is wrong. And this is a total disconnect from the Creator. And I believe that we are in that day and hour where this is our final hour to say, wake up, he's coming, get ready, otherwise they're going to be completely lost forever. And, you know, living according to self-fulfillment in flesh is nothing but destruction.
True, and I just want to add before I turn to Quartrell that actually the Talmudic tractate, I believe in Sota, talks about where everything will be topsy-turvy. And various scenarios are given. I don't remember the exact page. Maybe I'll take upon myself without a vow to pull out those teachings in the Talmudic tractate of Sota for maybe hopefully next week's show to show that you know, our Jewish tradition doesn't disagree with what you just said, Rebecca. That we just want to remind everyone that the idea of end of days, as we say in Hebrew, Ketz Yamim, the word Ketz not only means end, but it also means beginning. So it will be the end of the days of the rulership of people, you know, enforcing or promoting consciously or subconsciously evil, and it will be the days of the Messiah where good will be shining forth, and everyone at a certain point will have the freedom of choice to cling on and to attach to this goodness, or they might unfortunately suffer the fate of the hardened heart of the Paro, that type of mentality, or the hardened mentality of Cain, who questioned if he's his brother's keeper. So I'm hoping and praying that the majority of the human family condition, human family experience, will not choose the way of Paro and Cain. And I also remember seeing a teaching from Lubavitch Rebbe, which was stated in the mid-1980s, where he said, we don't need and I guess I don't remember the population count in the early 1980s. We said we don't need 1 billion people to die to bring the redemption. So we, you know, in the Hasidic world, we do promote an expansion of consciousness, and we pray with all our fervor. And may we all be blessed with that fervor that the redemption comes in a peaceful, pleasant way, and not a, you know, brimstone and fire way, which it could be for those. And probably, you know, for those who are living the Paro type of consciousness or the Cain type of consciousness. Quartrell, your take on these matters.
It's an interesting conversation, but I don't have a comment at the moment.
Okay. Thomas, your thoughts on these ideas? Thomas? Are you there? Well, Thomas seems to have walked away from the room. Rabbi, I forgot. Did I ask your opinion on this matter? I don't think so.
I believe you did.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm watching the clock, and I'm multitasking, and I'm not the greatest multitasker in the world. So we'll turn now to Genesis chapter 4, verse 15. And please forgive me, Rabbi, if I forgot that I asked you, and I'm sorry that I'll have to play back the archive version. to internalize what you had to offer. Please forgive me. So we're now going to chapter 4, verse 15, and we see that God said to him, meaning Cain, quote, "Therefore whoever kills Cain shall suffer sevenfold vengeance." And God placed a mark on Cain so that whoever found him would not kill him. Now this is pretty deep. I mean, we see it to be in earlier verses in this chapter that first Cain said, "Am I my brother's keeper?" which was, so to speak, on his sense, a rhetorical question, which is a question he shouldn't ask in a rhetorical question, because God knew the answer. And of course, if Cain was having this discussion with the Creator, obviously he had prophetic type of sensitivities. Later on, he was in this chapter, the Most High told him that he was going to be a wanderer, and the earth wouldn't give the produce as it should to him. Cain then responded that his sin is too great to bear, and then he acknowledged to the Creator that he's going to be banished, and the countenance of the Creator is being concealed from him, and he had great fear now that he would be killed. So God's response is, okay, I'm going to place a mark on you. What type of mark is this? So we're going to go into the oral Torah traditions. What type of mark was placed on Cain? Now, a person might wonder from the oral Torah tradition why God had said this. Since the seven Noahide commandments, or again, the opinion says there were six universal commandments were given, one which prohibited premeditated murder. Obviously, Adam as a prophet would have taught these commandments to his children. So is that implied that even though that Adam would have taught Cain and Abel, although Abel was already dead, is there some sort of implication that God was going easy on him because Cain did not know the meaning of murder? Well, actually, I'm pulling from the Torah anthology, this case scenario, which is an instruction for us even in the 21st century, is that it's very much like learning how to, when we talk about the laws of eating kosher meat, that one must inspect, when one inspects the animal that was ritually slaughtered, there must be determination if whether or not there are lesions, say like on the lungs or other different sensitive organs, if it would render it treif or non-kosher. But let's say a person learned what is written in the books on how to recognize what would make a lung kosher or not. A person might know the terminology, but he would surely not know how to apply it. A person would have to go to the slaughterhouse and study what the lungs actually look like and see what the terminology actually means. So the Torah anthology goes on to say the same was true of Cain. Even though he was forbidden to commit murder, he did not know, up until the point, unfortunately, when he committed his terrible deed, that a person could be killed by having his throat slit. And seeing that he never saw such a thing, he might have thought that cutting one's throat is no worse than cutting the hand. He therefore was not punished so severely. But everyone knew what murder was, and that the punishment would be swift and harsh. So with this perspective from the oral Torah tradition, that God had actually provided a way to rescue Cain from the wild animals, because Cain thought that anything that anyone will see will kill me, including the wild animals, in order to make sure that the animals would not attack him, and to allow him to travel without fear, that God placed a sign on that all would recognize him and not attack him. So there's different types of opinions as to the nature of this sign. On a more esoteric level, that it's brought down that some say that one of the names of the name of the Creator was engraved on his forehead. According to another opinion, the sun rose for Cain before its time, and when the animals wanted to attack Cain, it was nighttime when wild beasts usually prowl along with other harmful forces. So God made the sun rise so they would know to keep away from Cain, just as an axiomatic teaching that demonic forces have no power by day, so they have no power over Cain. So others dispute this, saying that Cain was wicked and certainly not deserving of God performing such a miracle for him. According to this, the sign of Cain was leprosy, and since he became leprous, the animals recognized him and would not come close to him. Now here's another interesting opinion, that God gave to Cain a dog as a constant companion. Since he was afraid of animals, God gave him an animal as a pet, and as they traveled, the dog would lead and Cain would follow. Now, according to that opinion, it would make you know, quite common sense why to this day there seems to be an affinity between human beings and dogs, and vice versa. Once the dog is taken in by the owner of him or her, whatever type, whatever species, whatever sex that dog is. So another thing was that whatever sign was given, that according to the oral Torah tradition, God did this because Cain confessed that he had sinned. And God wanted to make known for people who sin a chance that they should not think that once a person sins, there is no longer any help for him or her. One must realize that if one repents completely, one is no longer subject to the punishments mentioned in the Torah. But, however, that Cain did not confess, his repentance was not a complete one, and therefore it was decreed that vengeance would be extracted from him after 7 generations, as we see, as later on we see that Cain was actually killed by one of his descendants. So I just bit off a lot for everyone to chew here. With all due respect, I'd like to start with the rabbi. Rabbi, what do you think is the instruction here with all these different opinions that we can take today as human beings in the 21st information age, that we can be marked by some sort of sign of God? Maybe not a mark on our head or with a dog or whatever, or the sun rising before us, that we should be wary of our deeds.
Well, yes, of course. And I have to say that the time that I came across the interpretation of the mark as the dog, I was completely astounded by it. I have to follow along with that just because we know that God does work within the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
And this affinity with the dog and man goes back before recorded time. So it does make sense, because a mark on the head really isn't going to guarantee anything, because when the person's back is turned, nobody sees the mark. A light, if you're in a cave or something, that doesn't guarantee that you will be, a light will be on you. But a dog is something else. When you see a dog, I mean, when the owner of a dog is attacked, what happens? What is the first thing the dog does? They stand between the aggressor and the owner.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, I have to agree that this shows that we cannot fall so far from God that we cannot return.
That's right. There is a teaching from the Lubavitcher Rebbe that even if a person does in fact commit, and may we always be spared of this heinous act of a premeditated murder, if in a scenario where there was a based in, a rabbinical court, we're talking about a Jewish person now, that they had committed a premeditated murder and in fact there were witnesses and they were warned and they committed the act despite being warned by 2 proper witnesses and they were sent to the death penalty, they are given a chance to make a formal confession in order that although their life will be taken through the death penalty, that they will be guaranteed a place in the world to come, because they realize they must rectify that heinous crime. Now, again, today we don't have death penalties according to the Torah. We have secular law, and that's a whole discussion unto itself, which I really don't want to get into right now. And also the 7 Noahic commandments are thoroughly filled with different types of death penalties. But the point is now, I think for all of us as socially minded, community-minded human beings is just, you know, to live the right life. But understand that what goes around comes around, and if we get involved in things which are pretty heinous, God forbid, that the Most High is watching us, and there will be a communication to us through the physics of creation, which is dealing with the energy matter of our physical lives, and it is good for us to take note that whatever happened to Cain can happen to us in our own modern life story, if, God forbid, we go to that point of being so drunken with some sort of bloodlust to commit a premeditated murder. Cartrell, your take on these matters. You've served in the armed forces. You've known the difference between life and death. Any comments on these teachings?
I remember a Marine colonel once told me sometimes he has to order men, 3 of you to go east and 4 of you to go west. And he knows the 3 who are going east are most likely going to be slaughtered, but it advances the battle, you know.
Right.
Yeah, that is the battle.
Uh-huh. But if it's, you know, for a descent, you know, I mean, war is such a horrible occurrence in the human experience, but I'm not equivocating that with, say, like a person is stalking another person with a knife with the intent of not just taking their money, but just wanting to kill them because whatever, they were insulted or they were disrespected. But I'm talking about that type of scenario that, you know, as that was what happened, you know, back way back then between Cain and Abel. Rebecca, your take on these matters.
So much is going through my mind on this. First of all, I think about the fact that we serve such a loving God that if he were not as loving as he is, he could have destroyed Cain immediately
mm-hmm.
for what he did.
Mm-hmm.
But he chose to let him live. And even though he may have put a mark on him, I don't quite understand what that mark was because, like you said, there's so many speculations on it. It's hard to really pinpoint what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But he showed mercy. And it is, so to me, it proves that the God we serve gives us chance after chance after chance because his sole desire to have fellowship with us, to bring restoration to us,
mm-hmm.
to live a life that is solely focused on him so that not only can he bless us, but he blesses us to be a blessing to others.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's all about. And that's what I see in Jerusalem. When you look at the IDF, they represent the heart of God in such a way that it is mind-boggling. They can turn around and be attacked by someone, and then if that person gets injured, they quickly gather them up and take them to a hospital to be taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is what the Lord, the God that we serve, is all about. And Cain was... I can't quite explain what the whole scenario was behind that mark, but that's what I see when I see the story of Cain, if that's making any sense.
Thank you. I appreciate you. I mean, I did some communal work when I lived in Israel, and I can tell you that those soldiers, I know the mass media likes to call our cousins, the Arabs, the David, and we being the Goliath, little tiny Israel, surrounded by 23 Arab, primarily Islamic, faith-based societies. Well, there is a splattering of Arabic Christians there, but I can tell you that we truly are the David in the Middle East, and from the nation, the country of Israel is not. I just want to clarify. You know, from my perspective, I am not a Zionist Jew, but I love my fellow Jews and I love my fellow human beings, the Noahides. But we do not see it from my perspective. It was the beginning of the redemption, but rather was a present after all the blood that was spilt the 12 previous years in the past 2,000 years, all over the diaspora for the Jewish people. But the real kingdom of Israel will be reestablished by the Messiah, the direct descendant of Solomon and David. Thomas, any viewpoint on what we're talking about, what we can learn today about what happened, how the Most High had mercy on Cain?
Well, as you know, I study a lot of Rabbi Nachman's writings, so I know what he says the sign was.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in the end, something else that he teaches about this very thing is that the murder, not just with Cain and Abel, but with anyone, is the ultimate distancing oneself from God.
Mm-hmm.
Because Rabbi Nachman writes, it says, if he turns the earth back into formlessness and emptiness, bereft of God's presence, you've taken something that you can never replace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God forbid somebody stole a dollar. But if they did, they could replace that. They could make amends for that.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a life in the wrong way, that's not something you can replace. And so that separation that you cause when you do that is grave, grave, grave consequences upon your soul. So that would be what I have to say about that.
True. With that being said, thank you, Thomas. I'd like to profusely thank And because we also had Ron Williams, and he left us prematurely. Well, because he had to, because when Ron leaves the show, it's because he's off to do good things. I'd like to thank, just in the order that I have the telephone numbers right in front of my radio monitor board, I'd like to thank profusely Rebecca Vanderwerth of North Carolina, Rav Nachman of Michigan, Thomas Eason of Arkansas, and Cartrell Gore of Brooklyn, one of my neighbors. And I just want to mention everyone can reach out if they want a further fellowship with Rebecca Vanderwerth on Facebook. And Rabbi Nachman, I understand, do you still have a show on Blog Talk Radio?
Yeah, we have two shows on Blog Talk Radio.
So plug them away.
Yeah, we're on Tuesday night at 8 p.m. We have the Shul Study Hall, which we are studying the Talmud right now. And on Wednesday night, we have our regular Torah study at 8 p.m.
And that's in Michigan, that's still Eastern Standard Time?
Yes, still Eastern Standard Time. We're right on the edge.
Okay. Okay.
Is it the same telephone number?
No, it's not, and I don't have the number in front of me. I'm sorry.
Well, Rav Nachman, please promote your future shows on my Facebook page. My Facebook page, and I'm more than happy to share it with other people in the Jewish and Noahai community. Rebecca, thank you very much for coming on. Any summarizations you'd like to give?
Well, I mean, as usual, I always get so much out of these broadcasts. And
thank you, ma'am.
Unfortunately, I was one of the ones that was raised without, you know, the Hebrew teaching, even though I have Jewish in my bloodline. And I just want to say I am so grateful for the fact that we have, you know, modern technology and that I'm able to link up with those who teach the Torah, who are, you know, just of the Jewish faith. And you just have no idea how much of a blessing it is to me. And thank you, Rabbi, for telling us about your show, because I really look forward to getting a more in-depth teaching from you as well.
Beautiful. Beautiful. I love this type of network. I'm getting goose pimples from it. Thomas, thank you for coming on the show today, and you're also found on Facebook. Any concluding words?
All I would say is just for everybody, regardless of what the name they put in front of themselves, whether it be Jew, Noahide, Christian, strive for a relationship with the Creator. That's all there is.
Amen. And last but not least, Cartrell Gore, thank you very much. And as the president of the Booker T. Washington Business League, would you like to give a phone number people could contact you to partner with you to make New York City a better place to live?
Okay, you can call my 24-hour answering services, 718-670-3717. But my parting words for this to today, aside from Luther O. Benedel Deem, is never argue with the people who serve your food. That's what my father taught me.
So it's better to leave your servers of your food in a good mood, or they might
correct.
Okay, with that being said, Blessed Souls, thank you very much for tuning to me. This was to me a little taste of the banquet hall that we talked about the beginning of the show. We're going to conclude, of course, with our flagship concluding song called Every Day by David Dome. Will help us get back home to realize that our Tzelem Elohim is no dream. Our divine image is here to help us get from the scrimmage. And just remember, if you're listening to the show as it was a live broadcast today, or you're going to listen to the archive version, just remember, you have to be good, because the Teva Tov Lehetiv is the nature of the good to do good, the source of all goodness, the Creator. If He put you in this world, you got a lot of good in you. Take care, everyone, and hopefully next Sunday we'll be rejoined by our co-host, Rebecca Vanderwerth, and Rav Nachman, and Cartrell Gore, and Thomas Eason, and Ron Williams, and hopefully even Dennis Ryan, to add one more person to the banquet hall. Take care, everyone.
reflection in others across your heart. When you learn this, you will love. Every day is a lesson in exercising restraint.
I have to agree with that.
Too much kindness is destructive. A balloon that's set to pop. But the love must never stop. Yeah, we'll find a way. Learning every day. Every day. Every night's a window.
Thank you.